John chapter 11, the first 44 verses of the chapter. John chapter 11, starting at verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. And then after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. And the disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews have sought to stone you, and you're going back there again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. And then he said, after that he had said to them these things, Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. His disciples said, Lord, if he's sleeping, he'll get well. However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought he was speaking about his taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Then Thomas, who was called the twin, or the doubter, said to his fellow disciples, Let's go, that we may die with him. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, he will give you. Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. When she had said these things, she went her way secretly and called Mary her sister, saying, The teacher has come and is calling for you. As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. But Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha had met him. And the Jews who were with her in the house, comforting her, when they saw Mary rise up quickly and went out, they followed her, saying, She's going to weep at the tomb. Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and he said, Where have you laid him? And they said to him, Come and see. And Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, See how he loved him. And some of them said, Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, groaning in himself again, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone which lay against it. And Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be a stench. He's been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? And then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. Now when he said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. His face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, loose him, and let him go. That far, as we read from God's Word. In the course of John's recount, we are now after Hanukkah, after December, chapter 10, verses 40 to 42. He went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was baptizing at first, and there he stayed. Many came to him and said, John performed no sign, but all the things that John spoke about this man were true, and many believed in him there. So Jesus has, after the Feast of Dedication, which was chapter 10, and that's what we would call Hanukkah today, Jesus kind of fades away until his time comes at Passover. That is his hour. This hour, it's not exactly clear where he goes. John was first baptizing at a place called Enon on the east side of the Jordan River. Jesus goes there, but he's gone for 3 months. The synoptics have him in a place called Perea. That's a kind of a county, a small jurisdiction. That was east of Jordan, south of the Sea of Galilee. It was rural. It was away from Jerusalem and its intrigues and its plots. It was not an area well attended by the authorities. So if you'll pardon the expression, Jesus has been lying low for these 3 months or so. Out of sight? Out of mind? Well, his timetable is not set up that way. And so those who have been listening to him are coming to trust him. Are they his disciples? Well, they've become disciples. Are they true disciples? Or are they just followers for a time? We're not told. A significant number of them probably are among those who are walking with him down to go to Passover in a little bit, and then going across the Jordan River at Jericho and up to Jerusalem. Then seeing Zacchaeus, and seeing the others who were born who were blind, and the miracles that Jesus did. John picks up the narrative here. Now a certain man was sick. He was Lazarus of Bethany. That was the town of Martha and Mary. Now that takes us back to Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42. It happened as they went that they entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. She had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she approached him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me. Jesus answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. And Mary has chosen that good part, which will not be taken away from her. In another account, she is the one who comes, who breaks a bottle of alabaster ointment, washes his feet with it, dries her feet with that and her tears, and then dries his feet with her hair. She's demonstrating her obeisance to him, her recognition of who he is. So Mary and Martha, knowing that Lazarus is sick. Now I propose to you that they don't think he has the flu. And they don't think he's suffering from a cold or from the measles. They wouldn't have troubled Jesus with that. This was a serious illness. And of course there were many serious illnesses in those days. There still are. But some of them we've learned how to conquer, and they hadn't learned to conquer them yet. So they recognize in this a disease that could easily be fatal. And so they sent. Therefore they sent to him, this is verse 3, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. The word there is phileo, not agape. Lord, the one who is your good friend, he is sick. Apparently, an enduring friendship had been in God's decree, which would appear to be in order if we're emphasizing Jesus' humanity as well as his divinity. And I'd like to propose that you should watch that in the course of this passage. So Jesus hears When Jesus heard that, verse 4, he said, "The sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." When Jesus heard, he does a couple of things. The first is he makes that comment. Who's he making the comment to? To the 12? And to the others who are following him in Perea? He's making the comment not because he doesn't know, but because he's prepared to call it to their attention so that they would watch and see what was going to happen. This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. He doesn't say that Lazarus will not die. He just says that it's not final. It's not the end. I'm not done with him yet. I suppose there's something that we ought to put in mind. It'll be one of our applications later. Not everything that happens that is bad, in our opinion, is bad. Sometimes, what is bad, in our opinion, is for a good reason, with a glorious end. Not just Lazarus' resurrection, but Christ's sacrifice, and, if you will pardon my saying it, the worst of the bad things that is really a good thing is Jesus' death and resurrection. And so here he's going to use Lazarus as a sign of his power over all of the creation, over the last enemy, which is death, over the thing that men fear most in all of the world. You may feel fear torture. You may feel how you're going to die, but you fear the fact that you're going to die. That's the problem. So that is a common fear among us. Jesus is prepared to demonstrate something to them. You remember the Pharisees have been asking for a sign? Okay? What more of a sign could you want than this? Well, let's go on and look at it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And there it is, agape. Jesus was committed to them. Jesus was committed to them. He was prepared, and by the use of that word, a demonstration, that he has chosen them as his, and they are his. And so he is giving himself for them. So that as he does this with Lazarus, he's giving himself for Lazarus. He's doing these things for him, and he's going to use it as a picture of what he's going to do for Lazarus and for the rest of us in the long term. Okay? So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed two more days in the place where he was. Wouldn't you have expected him to say, "Oh dear, I better go"? Well, you see, there's something that we're not always remembering about Jesus. Okay? Nothing that happens in Jesus' incarnation is a surprise. Except maybe to us. Nothing that happens in all of creation is a surprise to Jesus Christ. So now he's looking at this and he's saying, this is for a good end. This is so that the glory of the Son of God may be seen by you. So I'm setting this up. We've planned it before the foundation of the world. I'm setting it up and bringing it to pass. I'm going to make it so that there's no possible way anybody can say he was just comatose for a while. I'm going to let him die. And so Jesus, with what seems to be a lack of concern for a few moments, stayed 2 days in the place where he was. Then, after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." Now the disciples are saying, "Look, we're up here because of what happened back there in Judea. We're staying out of sight because of what the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the authorities of the day want to do to you and us. We're staying out of that. We don't want to go back there. Why do you want to go back there? Are you crazy?" So the disciples said to him, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you there." Implication, did you forget this? What happened to your memory? You're going to go back there for somebody who is sick? And I suppose you could say that the next line that would have come from their minds, if not their lips, was, "You're crazy. You are crazy." Jesus said, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? And if anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." Huh? Jesus, you're not following the conversation here. Jesus said, "Oh, yes, I am. Because what I am here to do is to be done when the time comes for it, during the daytime, in the light. I'm not going to do it in darkness. I'm not going to do it hidden. I'm supposed to do it out in the open. That's the way we have planned it from the beginning of the world. And so I am doing it at the time that I was told to do it, when I agreed to do it with my Father. We set it up this way. I'm going to do it when I'm supposed to do it." You would do that. You're not going to go out and try to cut hay in the dark. Well, you might do it now that we have lights on the tractors, but you still probably wouldn't. Not unless you were afraid of a good rainstorm. Jesus says, "Look, you keep thinking that I came to be a teacher. You keep thinking that I came to be a good moral philosopher. You keep thinking that I came to turn everybody back to Judaism. I did not. I came to do something else. I came to be the sacrifice that fulfilled Judaism. I didn't come to fight the Romans. I didn't come to fight the Sanhedrin. I came to fight against my justice and your sin. And I have to do that job." The disciples still don't understand this. He said to them after that, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go to him that he may wake up." The disciples said, "We didn't understand that interlude of yours, but if he's asleep, then sleep is good for him and he's probably going to wake up. And if he wakes up, everything's fine. Why are you going to wake him up? He doesn't have an alarm clock. He doesn't have sisters or a puppy dog that's going to wake him up in the morning. What are you doing?" Then Jesus said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." So the disciples think this way, I think. Lazarus is dead. There's nothing can be done now. Why are you going back there except you're going to weep with his sisters and maybe some of the other people in town? Is this worth dying for? Okay? If he's really dead, there's nothing you can do about that. Right? What was that about the glory of God might be revealed in his Son? The glory of the Son of God might be revealed? Maybe there is something that could be done about that. But the disciples don't see it at all. Thomas opens his mouth for one of the few times Thomas opens his mouth. And he does what you almost expect out of Peter. He says, "Well, if he's going to go die, let's go along. We might as well die with him. Because if he goes and dies, everybody will come and find us eventually. And we're going to die anyway, so we might as well get it over with." And so they pack up their backpacks. They go. When Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. I'm sure he was buried with the appropriate spices. I'm sure that his family cared for him. I'm sure he was buried according to Jewish custom. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, a Sabbath day's journey. And many of the Jews had joined the women around Mary and Martha to comfort them. To comfort them concerning their brother. So now here are those who think that Jesus is suicidal, going back with him into this group of people right by Jerusalem. You're not even going quietly. You're not even going in a way that's going to be hidden. People are going to know this. Apparently, Lazarus and Mary and Martha were not unknown in the Jewish community, judging by the people who came. So that means the Sanhedrin knew about this too. And in fact, next week, Lord willing, we'll look at the response, which is partly the Sanhedrin's response. Because they were there. So now Jesus is going back and he's going to do the work that he was called to do, because his timetable is not to stay undercover. His timetable is to come out in the open and to do things that will irritate those who are seeking to kill him, in order that they will be resolved and resigned to putting him on the cross, which is what he determined is to happen. So he's setting this up. Many of the Jews had joined the women around Mary and Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Now Martha, as soon as she had heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him. Mary was sitting in the house. Martha. Well, I guess you have to look at Martha a little bit. Lazarus' sisters were probably unwed. Martha was the one who was more attuned to housekeeping, to doing the things that were necessary to support life. She may have been the cook. She may have been the chief bottle washer. She may have been those things. Mary was a little more otherworldly minded, perhaps. She was the one who had seen Jesus for what he was and was sitting at his feet, drinking in his words. Martha was going around making sure the water cups were filled and that there were snacks on the table. And she was upset that Mary wasn't helping her. Jesus begins his discussion with her, and it's a little bit vague. Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, he will give you." Jesus says to her, "Your brother will rise again." Well, Martha had been paying enough attention. She understood that there would be a resurrection of the last day. She had been reading in the Psalms. She had been reading in Isaiah. She knew that was going to happen. But she doesn't see the connection here. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. But now there's nothing you can do, not even you. Who is he? Mary has a better idea, apparently. Maybe not a complete idea, but a better idea. Martha's kind of sitting there with, well, he's a great philosopher. He's a great prophet. He's a good man. He's a wonderful friend. He can do marvelous things. But death is final, and there's no way around that. Nevertheless, whatever you ask, God will give you. But there's no concept as to what that involves. When he says, "Your brother will rise again," she doesn't say, "Oh, good, that means you're going to raise him from the dead." She says, "I know he'll rise again at the resurrection of the last day." Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life. I have that power. I give that power. He who believes in me, though he dies, shall live. He who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" And then Martha opens up and she says what Jesus has been priming her to say. It's a profession of faith. Okay? That profession of faith is, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." It's a wonderful statement. It's just not complete. It doesn't go anywhere. "You are the Emmanuel who is to come and live with us. To be a good example, to encourage us, to show us that God hasn't forgotten us." "Oh, you mean you're the one who created the world and who has the power of life and death, and who can give that life and death any time you want, because you are God?" You remember the triumphal entry, where they're coming down the hill into Jerusalem and everybody's shouting, and they get down to town and somebody says down there, "Who is this?" And they said, "Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee." Okay? It was supposed to be a compliment. It was probably the biggest and greatest compliment the man who spoke it could imagine. But it's blasphemy. He's not a prophet. He's God Himself. If you don't see Him as God Himself, you don't understand what's going on. Martha says she sees that, but she doesn't know what that's going to mean. She's been listening to Jesus, whether it's John 5:29 or Luke 14:14, talking about in Luke the resurrection of the just, or the hour is coming and now is, when those who have faith will be raised up will rise up out of their graves at the judgment. Do you believe that He'll never really die? Your problem is that you think that that death is the biggest problem. Okay? That brings us to a second theme. First theme was bad things aren't always bad. Second, her confession is enough, even though it does not clearly see what is to happen. You are the anointed one. You are the Messiah. You are, from Isaiah 7:14, Emmanuel, living with us. But I don't know what that means. And the Spirit of God will teach us what that means, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. He will work in us. He will continue to teach us. And so our profession of faith doesn't have to be complete at the first. In fact, it probably won't be. So you will grow in grace and you will grow in understanding of the Lord. And as you grow in that understanding of the Lord, you realize there were things you didn't recognize before. Martha's going to get one of them in just a few minutes when Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth. And suddenly it's going to dawn on her, hey, wait a minute, this isn't a prophet. If he had said, Lord, please raise Lazarus from the dead, he might be a prophet. But he doesn't. He gives an order to His creation, and His creation obeys Him. Mary, the one who had sat at His feet in the Luke 10 passage, has not aided in the serving, Mary is still in the house. Martha does something which is probably typical of Martha, but a little bit strange in this context. When she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary her sister. And she lied to her sister. She went away and she said, Jesus, you really, really, really should talk to Mary. And I really, really want Mary to talk to you. And I really, really, really don't want her left out of this. So she went away quietly and then she called Mary and she said to Mary, the teacher has come and he's calling for you. Jesus didn't say that. Martha's trying to be the manipulator who makes everything work out. That was why she was the server. That was why she took care of the house. Mary was the one who was a little too spiritual for her own good, in Martha's opinion. As soon as she heard that Mary arose and quickly came to him. Now, Jesus had not come into the town, but he was at the place where Martha had met him, which was probably somewhere very near the cemetery, maybe at the edge of the cemetery. When she saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Jesus doesn't address her as he had addressed Martha, probably because he already knows her faith. He doesn't need to have her make a profession of faith. He's not interested in having that come out of her mouth and her mind, as it had already come out of Mary's in the other incident. Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews with her weeping, he groaned in his spirit and was troubled. Jesus is scared. Jesus doesn't know what to do. No. Jesus is looking at the pain of sin. He's looking at the pain of what that separation from God means. He's looking at the ultimate of the separations, the separation of body and soul of men. Okay? Separation between God has come from our birth, from our conception. Separation from one another as we grow up, as we develop our own personalities and we let people into them and we keep people out of them and we have places that we don't let even those people who are close to us come into. That separation's been there. This is the separation that scares everybody. Separation of body and soul. Jesus is looking at that. And he's seeing what devastation it does even to the people who know or should know better. And that brings us to theme number 3. Jesus is not callous. Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. If Jesus isn't callous, then the Father and the Spirit aren't callous either. So Jesus doesn't say, well, you guys deserve it. This is what you get. Peter says it this way. Beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. As strange as it may seem, God isn't happy to condemn anybody to hell. He will, please, but he's not happy to do it. It's as if, and I'll use a very poor example, simply because there's no way I can give you an example that matches what God did. If I want to write a play, and I want to show what sin does to a man, and so I write a play or a novel, and I show just how vile a person can be, with a reasonable start as a kid, you know, and growing up, and I show just how vile he can be, and how vile he can become, and how terrible he is, and then he dies at the end of the book, or the play. Am I a failure? If my goal was to demonstrate that, am I a failure? Am I evil? Because I wanted to say to people, this is what you become if you do these things? Now, Jesus isn't callous. God isn't callous. When these things happen, and he knows they will because he has determined they should, Jesus is groaning at the effect of the curse. The curse and sin. The effects of it do not leave Jesus callous. So Jesus says, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. The Lord here is simply, sir, a term of respect. You could translate it mister, and often it is. Then Jesus wept. Yes, just for those of you who may ever be in a Bible memory contest, and you may need a verse to get you over the hump and be the last one with more verses than anybody else, John 11:35. Jesus wept. Shortest verse in the Bible. But it's a dominating verse. Why would Jesus weep? Because here's one who is his, one whom he has loved, who goes through this aspect of the curse. And he has to go through that aspect of the curse. And Jesus says, and that's not what I like. I have something good going to come of it. I have even better things going to come of the picture in it. But I don't want to see somebody I love, somebody I'm concerned about, go through hard times. Or go through something like this. I know I will. I know I should. I know I must. I planned it this way. And the people look at him, Jesus weeping, and they say, see how much he loved him. Again, it's phileo, not agape. They don't understand the whole concept of serving him. They don't understand that Jesus is going to serve Lazarus in just a couple of minutes. All they can look at is saying, here's he lost his good friend, and he really was upset about that. We kind of thought he was a guy who was a little standoffish. We kind of thought he was a guy who was above the rest of us and thought he was. No, this guy really had feelings. If Jesus had feelings for Lazarus, then he also has feelings for us. I want to emphasize that. But there were some who said, these are probably not all of the Pharisees' school, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind, the one who had been born blind, also have kept this man from dying? If he really was that good a friend, why didn't he come immediately? Okay, well, just because he stayed there two more days, Lazarus was already dead by the time he got the message. But that, why didn't he come immediately? Couldn't he have done something that would have kept Lazarus alive? Why didn't he do this? Then Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And he said, "Take away the stone." And then Martha demonstrates where she still is. She says to Jesus, "Lord, it's going to stink. He's been dead 4 days. Why do you want to go in there where his stinking, rotting remains are? Are you going to weep over him there? What are you doing? Good enough that you came and you touched the gravestone and you say, 'Lazarus, I know you're in there and I miss you.'" Jesus says to her in a very gentle rebuke, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" Then they took the stone away from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and he said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." Jesus' prayer is not really a prayer. Jesus' prayer is said not because he doesn't know what he's going to do, not because he and the Father haven't already agreed to this, but so that the people who are listening, not just Mary and Martha, but all the people and the 12, all of the people who are there listening say, he prayed to God. He said, "I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me because of the people who are standing by. And so I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." He wants that repeated back to the Pharisees. He wants this incident repeated back to the Pharisees. Because it's how he's going to keep them aware that he hasn't gone anywhere and that he is still everything he said he was. And he's going to give them this problem now. And this real problem is, how are we going to deal with this? He healed a man who was born blind. Never happened in the history of the world. Now he walks up to the graveside of a man who's been dead for 4 days, and he takes that man. When he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." He doesn't say, "God, make Lazarus come forth." He says, "Lazarus, come forth." You remember when they were crossing the sea and the disciples were upset? Jesus was sleeping in the back of the boat and the wind was up and it was swamping the boat. And they said to Jesus, "Master, don't you care that we're drowning?" And Jesus stood up and he rebuked the waves and they stopped. The wind ceased and the waves stopped. And the disciples said, "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" The disciples here, Mary and Martha and all of those who are watching, are supposed to be thinking, and they do, okay? They're supposed to be thinking, "What manner of man is this? The dead stand up and walk. And they're not zombies. The dead come back to life when he says, 'Get up.'" I don't know how many of you have been around someone who has just died. You've heard me say it before. I've been there. I've had the opportunity to do that. And when you're taking the body down from the bed where the patient died, down to the morgue where you've got to put them in the refrigerator till the funeral home can come and collect the remains, and nobody else wants to touch them. So you're the only one down there trying to do this. Okay? No matter what you say to that corpse, it doesn't respond. No matter what you plead with, no matter how logical you are about what has to happen next, nothing happens. Jesus talks to the corpse, and the corpse obeys him. It comes back to life. Okay? When we see this next week, we're going to see the response. And the response is going to be, "Wow," and "Oh no, now he's really put us down." But right now, we're just interested in this. Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, his face wrapped in a cloth. So here's this corpse. 4 days ago, he was alive. He's been dead for these 4 days. And now Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. He can't move his feet. They're tied together. His hands are tied, probably to his side, maybe in front of him. Okay? So he has to wiggle his way off of the stone slab he's lying on and hop out. Okay? And the grave cloth over his face probably lets him see just a little bit enough so he can know where the path is to get out the door. Okay? This is not something you would do if you were trying to put somebody on. And so the demonstration between the 4 days and between how Lazarus comes out is a demonstration of Jesus' power and authority over his creation. And nobody misses it. And we're not to miss it either. That you may believe. That you may believe who Jesus is and what he came to do and what his power was and what his intentions were. I suppose if I can review the points that I wanted to you to remember. In God's providence, a terrible thing may actually be a great blessing. And the cross is the ultimate example. There is nothing more horrible and nothing more terrible in the history of mankind than that we should do that. And yet it's the source of our salvation. So that terrible thing, one man called it the great U catastrophe, the great happy catastrophe. Jesus was crucified. So God's providence is his shepherding care by providing us with exactly what we need, even if it's restrictive to us. Surely, being dead and in the tomb for 4 days was restrictive to Lazarus, and the separation and the funeral were restrictive to Mary and Martha. But the glory of God's power and Christ's identity changed that whole thing to a time of joy, the joy of restoration, a demonstration of who he is and his power. It's a wonderful good beyond anything anybody could have expected. That's not the only time that happens. That's not the only place it happens. God sometimes sends illness to us, and we consider it a disaster. He sometimes sends things to us that we think, well, we think really are awful things. We may be desperate, but the desperation drives us to prayer. We may be frustrated of a desire by the lack of a desire that we have or a desire that isn't being given to us. And it may drive you to the Word and to sanctification to find out why and maybe to change your mind about what it is that your dream was or what you wanted. God's work isn't always kind and gentle and stroking your back. Sometimes God's work is driving you to where you ought to be. And those things that drive us to it are good things, even if they look bad. Secondly, Martha's confession is sincere. The words are sincerely said, even if they're not completely understood. God does not expect us to confess everything that he is, only as much as he has shown us. His will, to make us grow into the rest and into the size and strength and faith that he wants, if we are really his. If I were to turn you to John chapter 14 and look at verse 25. These things I have spoken to you while being present with you. But the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all things that I said to you. So he's not going to leave us without his Spirit, who's going to be working in us, taking that profession of faith that we made and filling it out in ways that we couldn't have imagined. And he's going to do that, sometimes gently, sometimes not so gently. So the hurt that he causes in us may be prepared for us. It may be good for us, restraining our sin, directing us or pushing us to the proper place and trust before him. It's not a disaster. You break your leg. That's not a disaster. Even if you were in the finals of the World Cup soccer and you had a collision on the field and halfway through the first half you broke your leg and you couldn't play anymore, it's not a disaster. Except maybe to your dreams. And maybe for your dreams, it's a good disaster. I use those examples because I don't want to try to be too close to home. Jesus, point three, if I may, is not callous. We already read 2 Peter 3:8 and 9. If I were to turn you back to Psalm 103 and start at verse 13. As a father pities his children, so Yahweh pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourishes. The wind passes over it and it's gone. Its place remembers it no more. But the mercy of Yahweh is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to such as keep his covenant, and who remember his commandments to do them. If I went a few psalms over to Psalm 116 and verse 15, precious in the sight of Yahweh is the death of his saints. All of the things that we go through aren't there God saying, well, you sinners deserve it. All of them are there, and all of them he knows, and all of them he is with us in because he cares about us. Not just about our souls eternally. He who made pain knows it intimately, and he restrains it or loosens it according to what he knows is best. Since he knows and cares for us, he will not destroy us, but only build us up the way you build up muscles. I was a jock for too long. You build up muscles by tearing them down. You make the muscle go to the point of breaking in order that that night with reasonable nutrition and a little bit of sleep, the muscle comes back tomorrow just a little bit stronger. So it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. That's the way God deals with us. And last, of course, he who made life, gave life, takes life, gives life in the person of Jesus Christ, his Son. He does not abandon his chosen, nor cause them needless harm, nor cause them needless pain, but all is for your good as he has chosen you and he has chosen to train you. Lazarus is a sign. Lazarus is a demonstration that all those things that we think are bad, God doesn't. And so he brings good from it. Lazarus is probably very happy to be alive again. Mary and Martha are delighted. The disciples are still muttering. Huh? The Pharisees and their disciples, they're still saying, uh-oh, what's this going to cause now? But the glory of the Son was revealed, which was what he had in mind, so that he would be seen as the appropriate sacrifice for our sin, and therefore offered for it. Bow with me in prayer.